Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
I ate so much my clothes don't fit. I can't stand and I can't sit. Started in and I couldn't quit. I ate too much for dinner. I ate so much my pants are ripped. My snaps won't snap, my zips won't zip. I need a health club membership. I'm bulking up for winter. Pass the gravy, pass the rolls. Pass the green bean casseroles. And the mashed potato bowl. Have mercy on a sinner. Turkey dressing, pumpkin pie. Eat until you want to die. I'm just a North Wisconsin guy. Bulking up for winter.
The violin and vocals of Randy Sabine getting us underway today on Route 51 from our jam session on this show about this time last year. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we look forward to Thanksgiving with a Northern Wisconsin twist with author Mary Doherty, whose new cookbook is titled Life in a Northern Town, Cooking, Eating, and Other Adventures Along Lake Superior. Mary writes, gathering people around my table is a constant theme for me. I follow the breadcrumb trail of that inspiration. Let's dig in.
I ate so much that I'm in pain. Blood is rushing from my brain. I think I'll sit and watch the game, and I don't care who's the winner. I ate so much my socks are tight. My shoes won't tie. My shorts ain't right. I couldn't eat another bite. I'm bulking up for winter. Pass the gravy, pass the rolls. Pass the green bean casserole. And the mashed potato bowl. Have mercy on a sinner. Turkey dressing, pumpkin pie. Eat until you want to die. I'm just a North Wisconsin guy.
In her book, Mary showcases not just the food from her Northwoods table, but the beauty of the changing seasons of the Lake Superior shoreline near her hometown of Bayfield. In photos, personal experiences and stories, and of course, recipes. We're going to talk about all of that today, and we'd like to hear from you as well. Do you have a special recipe or Thanksgiving tradition that you'd like to share with us, or a story about the holidays with your family and friends, or maybe a favorite place in north central Wisconsin that makes you warm this time of the year? You can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on our website, wpr.org/route51, and I will read it live on the air. And if you're interested in Mary's book, it is published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and you can find out more about it at wisconsinhistory.org. Mary, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Have you ever written a book before?
Never. Not even one.
Well,
never even thought about it, actually.
Well, this first one is pretty impressive for a first try.
I know. It's pretty funny how the breadcrumb trail leads me to all sorts of places.
Well, what made you want to write this book?
I didn't really set out wanting to write a book, to be honest with you. I'd started my blog called The Cookery Maven. I think in 2011 or 2012, I'd owned a restaurant in northern Wisconsin, and I was kind of trying to – that wasn't working out so well, and as a way to kind of bring myself back into my kitchen and the things that I loved about my life, I started taking pictures and writing about it, and that blog grew into a book.
Well, it's an interesting book. It's mostly recipes, mm-hmm. but you've also got – kind of like travelogue segments, and you've got vignettes, little mm-hmm. stories about your family and friends and your dogs, and the collection of photographs. And it's really a celebration of Lake Superior and the culture there and the cuisine.
I think that is what I found interesting about food as I learned a little bit more about it, is that food belongs in the context of family, in the context of home, in the context of where you live. When we take food out of the story, food loses a lot of its power, its sacredness, when we don't talk about where it comes from, who you're feeding, and all that business.
Now, you also break down the book according to the seasons. So mm-hmm. you've got a chapter on spring, a chapter on summer, fall, and winter, and talk about how the seasons bring their own foods, if you locally source things,
yeah.
and also stories about food and stories about the people and the places that are important to you.
With northern Wisconsin, you know, Bayfield's practically at the tip of Wisconsin. We're about as far north as you can get. When I go down and do things in the southern part of the state, I say, well, I'm from northern Wisconsin. I'm like, are you from Wausau? I'm like, no, there's a whole lot of state north of Wausau. And so the seasonal concept about eating is it's a real thing. I mean, we have grocery stores and such, but we don't have the access to food that a larger city would have. I mean, we've got great grocery stores. I'm not saying that. But we do tend to live in step with the seasons a little bit more because they're so present.
And how did you learn how to cook?
I remember the first – I didn't cook at all growing up. I'm the oldest of seven kids. And when you have a mother with seven kids, she doesn't want a lot of business and screwing around in the kitchen. And so I always liked to eat, and I have really great memories of going to my Grandma Duffy's house on Sundays and family dinners and all that. But I made my first meal for my husband, my now husband, Ted. I made chicken fajitas, and like I went to the grocery store and bought the Schilling's fajita mix thing, the spice pack. And I don't know. It was that moment when we sat down to dinner, I thought, this is cool that you can make something and make someone happy.
So this is just something that you kind of picked up on through inspiration, almost like words come to a poet or music comes to a musician.
Yeah, I think as a kid, I saw the power of food to bring people together. I didn't cook. I wasn't a cook up until I was like probably 20, but I saw what happens when you gather people around a table, and that was what was and continues to be what's most interesting to me.
You did own a restaurant. So
yes.
How did somebody who never learned how to cook end up owning a restaurant?
Let me tell you about that, because I'd never even worked in a restaurant. I worked at Taco Bell when I was 14, and it was a very bad experience. So I quit, and I went to go work at a retail store.
I'll share my experiences working at Burger King when I was 14.
It was a very trippy experience. But and I don't know what happened. We had a small sailboat. And I lived on our boat in the summer with the kids, and we bought a house in Bayfield in 2007. I met the woman who became my business partner at the restaurant, and we walked into this beautiful old building, and I fell in love with. There was a rounded wall on the second floor, and I thought, if someone loved this building enough to round a wall with plaster and lath, we decided to get by the building and renovate it and reopen her restaurant.
What was the name of the restaurant? I'm sure some people who are listening were patrons of yours.
It was called Good Time Restaurant. It's now closed. But Renee had her restaurant burned down in Washburn, and then she and I had a cheese business together that we sold cheese at Kowalski's, which is a grocery store in Minneapolis. And when her restaurant burned, we were just looking for a kitchen and walked into this big old farmhouse, and I fell in love with the rounded wall, and we decided to open a restaurant.
Very cool. And but you ended up giving it up.
I did. It was hard. I mean, like the tricky thing about a breadcrumb trail is that there's nothing linear about living a life in a way where you decide just to follow all the little pieces. And looking back on it, the restaurant was very, very, very important to where I am now. At the time, it was probably one of the hardest things I'd ever done. I had five little kids. All under the age of 14, I think, when we opened the restaurant.
You working 7 days a week?
It's hard. Restaurant, I mean.
Were you the cook or
no,
the manager?
I did the front of the house and bartending and the, wine program. I miss that part. I miss bartending, funnily enough. Bartending's fun. But it just got to be hard. It wasn't really in line with where my true values were, which was being at home with the kids and trying to do meaningful work, but something that wasn't taken away from my family.
You have a lot of Oriental recipes in this book. Was that a staple at your restaurant, or is that something you picked up on your own?
No, that's just what we – when we lived in Minneapolis, because that's where I came from, we ate a lot of takeout. And so when you move to northern Wisconsin, I can't go get mushu pork or pho or the Indian meatballs, and so you have to learn how to cook all that stuff.
Why don't you share one of the recipes with me, the Vietnamese beef stew.
That's kind of based on that that Vietnamese soup called pho, which is just basically a bone broth. But I love the mixture of cumin, cinnamon, coriander. I love that interplay of those spices that sometimes we can see as more sweet in our culture, but they're also used in a savory way. And stews are good. My kids are older now, and three kids are in college. But when they were little, you have to come up with stuff that you can throw in a crock pot because it's like soccer practice, homework.
Yeah.
It's hard to make everything work. So stews and soups are good.
What are the secrets of the Vietnamese beef stew? If I was going to make it right now, what would I have to do?
don't skip on the whole brown. When you look at a recipe and it says brown the beef, I think sometimes you think, eh, does it really matter? Well, it does matter to get that nice brown crust, and don't crowd the pan when you start that process to brown your beef. Don't throw it all in there just because you think you're going to save some time, which you will save time. And if that's what you're looking to do, go ahead and do it. But that browning that beef and getting that nice crust does make a difference and just adds that little bit more depth of flavor.
What makes it a Vietnamese beef stew as opposed to an American beef stew? What's distinctive about that?
Just the spices. It's that, you know, you wouldn't have a beautiful French beef stew with red wine and throw some cinnamon in there. What I've learned is the cuisines across the world are very similar. We add our flavor, our cultural flavor, in the forms mostly of spices.
Well, one of the messages in the book is that you should eat food that's in season and as much as possible food that's locally sourced, either from sources that you've got available to you in your hometown or preferably from your own garden.
Ideally, in a perfect world, I do truly believe that that's the way we came up eating, you know, from way back in the day. And we've kind of gone a little bit far afield with that, with all the food we have available to us year-round. I think that food that's in season is just healthier for you. But there is the component of sourcing food, making sure that it fits into your family's budget as well, which is a really important piece that we often don't talk about very much in the local food. But it's important to do what you can, but don't put any judgment on if you can't, because we're all just trying to get through the day.
One of the local ingredients that people all across northern Wisconsin use is maple syrup. And you've got a favorite place, the northernmost sugar bush, where you get your syrup. Tell me about the northernmost sugar bush and the people who run it and how they make the syrup that you use.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you one thing. When you go to the grocery store and you look at Aunt Jemima, and she's about $4, and the maple syrup from local is about, you know, between 8 and 10, trust me, it's worth more than that. Trying to make maple syrup is so much work. And good friends of ours, Julie and Charlie, they have a sugar bush out. I think it is probably the northernmost sugar bush. And you're out there when it's cold. You have to tap the trees, put the taps in, hang the buckets, haul the buckets, put them in the evaporator, boil it all down, and then bottle it. But it's really fun. You can make it into a party.
And it takes a lot of maple sap to make maple syrup. What's the ratio? You've gone through it. You've seen it. I don't need it.
It's a lot. I don't know what it is either, but it's a lot. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of maple sap to make. And then especially if you want to boil it down into sugar, which is, you know, a granulated sugar, that's even more extraction. But it is, I don't know what's nice, because our winters are long. And it's kind of the first knock on the door that summer's coming.
Right, right. Yeah. When the sap starts running, there's a reason for it.
Yeah, you know that it's not going to be cold forever.
Well, you've got a number of maple syrup recipes, maple glazed duck.
I was just looking at that recipe because I've got some duck in the freezer.
Well, tell the folks what they would have to do to make a maple glazed duck.
You could – I need to look at the recipe. I don't remember. I was just looking at it because my kids are coming home for Thanksgiving, and I have some duck breast in the oven or the freezer. One thing I do like, I've started using duck breast as opposed to the whole duck, but it is – the one thing that's really tricky – duck has a lot of fat on it.
You
especially
bet.
Especially the breast. And so you – this is the one. Oh, yeah. This one you just make a glaze and you just bake it, which is good. You got to make sure that oven's hot though to get the the skin nice and crispy. But I know the combination of maple syrup, honey, and sherry vinegar. I love sherry vinegar because it still has that bite, but there's a little more roundness to it, and it really does well with because maple syrup has a roundness too. That is not terribly sweet. There's a little bit, there's like a savory hint with maple syrup that goes really well with sherry vinegar.
So how hot do you have to have the oven in order to get the crispy skin on the duck?
Well, I say 425, and you might even want to do it a little. Everyone's oven is so different. That was the trickiest part about writing a cookbook is that, you know, people don't, my oven isn't calibrated down to the the degree, but I would definitely say before 25, 450, because otherwise the fat is so thick on a duck that it can get flabby. You want it to be crispy, like cracklings.
And what's the secret to making the glaze? Do you just throw the things together and let them kind of cook together? And
yeah, I'm a big believer in just throw it together. I mean,
Well, you're a woman after my own heart.
I think we make it too complicated. A friend of mine came over to shoot a video for I want to open a cooking school in the spring, and we were shooting the video and talking about food. And I think that sometimes we get a little too precious with food, a little too – it's just like – I don't know. And I think that jokingly said it's just dinner, and I think that's what we're going to call the video. Like, it's just dinner. We're not trying to write – no one's going for a Nobel Peace Prize. We're just making duck, so relax.
Well, how food is raised is also important to you as well. You've taken a stand against a really big hog farm near your hometown. 26,000 hogs is the proposal. Now, it hasn't gone through yet. Right near the Lake Superior Basin, as you describe it. Why is that important to you?
I think it's important because I've traveled around the state talking about factory farms, and because it's actually turned out to be my job. Again, the breadcrumb trail puts me in all sorts of weird places. And I think that each community deserves the opportunity to answer three questions about themselves. Who are you in your community? What do you value? And then how do you protect what you value? And for the answers up in Bayfield County, that didn't fit.
How do the people that you live with in Bayfield feel about the proposed hog farm? We're talking about millions of gallons of pig manure right near the pristine, crystal clear waters of Lake Superior.
Yep. That is, overall, I would say that we don't want it. And unfortunately, the state took away our right to say no to a factory farm in 2006 with the passage of something called the Livestock Siting Law. So it's, you know, like all things, when you start a fire, you start with a little bit of kindling and a little bit of fire. And then to help that fire grow, you add new things into it. And I think that's what we've done in Bayfield. And I see it happening around the state where people are starting to ask themselves, who are we and what do we value? And now what are we going to do about it? And that's kind of bringing that, what I just said, back to the table. I've realized in doing this work, we need to start at the table. We need to start with conversation. We need to start with that connection that's inherent in the human spirit, which is we are inherently tuned to be in community.
You write, this is a quote from your book, "I had to make changes in my own kitchen. All food comes from someplace, and the food raised in Bayfield is possible because of our healthy soil and clean water." What were the changes that you had to make in your kitchen?
I didn't even know. So another word for factory farm is called CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation. And I didn't even know what that word meant when I got the message that a factory farm was moving in. So I, like most of us, I didn't know that there were consequences to the decisions that I made at the grocery store because I wasn't aware. It's not that I was seeking to harm people. I just didn't know what was going on. And so when we talk about local food, I like to say that we start where we stand and we make the road by walking. And I don't want anyone that shops at the grocery store to feel like, oh, I shouldn't. I don't want to join the talk about factory farms because I have to shop at a grocery store. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about open conversation. How do we make it fair and accessible for everybody?
Today on Route 51, we're looking forward to Thanksgiving with Mary Doherty, the author of Life in a Northern Town, Cooking, Eating, and Other Adventures Along Lake Superior. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you got a question for Mary, or maybe a favorite family recipe, maybe a story about the holidays, or a special place that you really love in north central Wisconsin, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or put a comment on the Route 51 webpage. That's wpr.org/route51. We're going to take a short break. Here are the Pointer Sisters.
And we serve the bones to Henry Jones, cause Henry don't eat no meat.
He shouts for bean sprouts.
Henry don't eat no meat.
Put together bacon.
Henry don't eat no meat.
Badly mistaken.
Henry don't eat no meat.
He's been on fish since 66.
Henry don't eat no meat.
And he gets his kicks in celery sticks.
Henry don't eat no meat.
Choke and grease when eating that cheese.
Henry don't eat no meat.
I'm in the mood for seafood.
Henry don't eat no meat.
But he
yak sack. You want seafood?
Henry!
You all fish, radish, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and sesame seeds.
Support for WPR comes from many small businesses. Saturday, November 25th is Small Business Saturday, a day that encourages shopping and dining at local businesses. WPR is proud of the support we receive from small businesses. Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
Tuna casserole. Ooh. You better chow down or it's gonna get cold. So eat it. I don't care if you're full, just eat it. Eat it. Open up your mouth and feed it. Have some more yogurt. Have some more Spam. It doesn't matter if it's fresh or canned. Just eat it. Eat it. Don't you make me repeat it. Have a banana. It doesn't matter what you had for lunch. Just eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Weird Al Yankovic taking us into our next segment of Route 51 with Mary Doherty, the author of Life in a Northern Town, Cooking, Eating, and Other Adventures Along Lake Superior. I'm Glenn Moberg. Once again, if you got a question for Mary, a favorite family recipe of your own, a story about the holidays, or a special place in north central Wisconsin that you'd like to share with us, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 webpage. That's wpr.org/route51. Well, Mary, Chris writes in to comment that the cranberry sauce sold in cans is bad for you, or at least that's what she claims. And she uses her own recipe, but she'd like you to discuss homemade cranberry sauce with local ingredients.
That I remember as a kid, when they would open the can on the Ocean Spray, and it would like plop out. It made a very particular sound. Once you've heard it, it kind of jiggles. But
I love how you can see the indentation of the can.
I know, it's so funny, isn't it? And it just like it sits there, and then you slice it. I never like that stuff because it's so tart. I have a cranberry and quince chutney or relish that you can use on here. It's cooked sometimes, but my mom always does a uncooked relish, which is just sugar, cranberries, and orange, and that's it. But this one was funny. I don't know why I got into beating my bonnet and decided I wanted to start figuring out what to do with quince. And so being in a northern town, when you order it from your co-op and no one else wants quince, you get a whole case of quinces to figure out what to do with. And so I did a lot of stuff with quince for about a week and a half. But I came up with this quince and cranberry chutney, which is just – quince is kind of a funny fruit because it looks a little bit like an apple. But it's super astringent when you eat it raw, like almost to the point where it puckers. It's like a lemon. But when you cook it, it gets this beautiful floral taste. It's really strange what happens with cooking with quince. So I just threw some quince in with cranberries and ginger and a little bit of sugar. I mean, it's really simple. I think sometimes it's best with, especially with Thanksgiving when there's so much going on around the table as far as, I mean, it's literally piled high with food. Keep some of the stuff simple.
What are you having for Thanksgiving this year?
I'm thinking.
And
about
who are you having?
Well, my kids will be home, which I'm so excited about. They're getting my daughter from school on Friday, and then the boys are coming home on Wednesday. And so, I have vegetarians in my house now. So I bought a pie pumpkin that I'm going to, because Sadie doesn't eat meat, so I'm going to stuff the pumpkin with the stuffing that I'm making for the turkey, and do that as well as turkey, and then. I'm going to do a cranberry relish. I want to come up with a new riff on mashed potatoes. I haven't figured out what that's going to look like. And then I do a dry brine on my turkey, which is – we were going to put the recipe in the cookbook, but it didn't get – you know, there's a lot of
– Well, explain that to folks who are novices at cooking. What is a dry brine, and why would you put it on a turkey?
Well, I think the special part about poultry is I love skin, the poultry skin, when it's crispy and, you know, like duck or chicken or – turkey. And so it's a wet brine is where you submerge the entire bird into water with spices and salt and such. A dry brine is where it's just a salt mixture. So I use, again, it's funny, we do eat a lot of Asian-inspired food. It has star anise and maple sugar, garlic, ginger, and then you pat it all over the bird and wrap it up tightly in saran wrap and let it sit for 3 or 4 days.
3 or 4 days?
Refrigerated. Really? Don't stick it don't leave it in the kitchen. But yeah, in the refrigerator.
But even refrigerated, that's a long time for a, you know, for a marinade or a brine like that. What does that do to the skin?
Well, it helps it because it, so that the salt, it's an osmosis, so the salt goes into the meat and then eventually comes back out. So when you, when you do a dry brine, stick the bird on a pan that'll catch the juices because you're going to get a lot of extraction of juice. But then it's just you pat it dry and that skin is already kind of queued up to be crispy because it's salted and it's dry.
Bayfield is your adopted hometown.
Indeed.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to a fortuitous boat trip a few years back.
Yeah.
It was like an epiphany for you, right? You pulled into the harbor and you said, well, that's home.
It was very strange. Again, back to, you know, how you end up where you end up. We had bought a small sailboat and I'm in Duluth Harbor, and I love Duluth as well, but it's a working harbor, so the water isn't exactly the cleanest. And my husband said, well, let's sail over to the Apostle Islands. And I was like, where are we going? Because I get seasick, and I didn't really like sailboats because they heel over, and it scared me. And so anyways, I took some Dramamine and went to bed and woke up at Sand Island. And I remember walking out of the cabin and into the cockpit and looking straight down. And we were anchored in probably 20 feet of water, and you could see all the way to the bottom.
Right.
I had never had that experience before.
Well, it's a fickle lake, and you write about that Lake Superior can be as smooth as glass all the way to the horizon without a ripple. And then just a couple of weeks ago, we had 30-foot waves.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's a—
Did you see those waves coming in?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I was driving the kids home from school, and there's so many things I love about my community, but one thing and just sticks in my mind. I was driving by the freeway, and I saw all these cars and people and their kids on the beach looking at the lake. The lake is, I don't even know how to say it without sounding super schmaltzy, but it's our heart in water form, the people that live up there. I mean, it drives our community. I can't describe it, but to see
Let me be super schmaltzy.
Yeah.
I think Lake Superior is a holy place.
I agree with you. I think there's something there. People ask me why I live there, and I say, because I can feel the earth's heartbeat in that place. It's easier to be a human when you know where you fit in, and you know where you fit in when you stand on the shores of that lake.
And I saw those waves coming in. I saw a video of people surfing in Lake Superior in a snowstorm with these, you know, 20-foot waves coming in.
It's cool. We went out, so my husband and I went out to the beach next morning to walk the dogs, and there was a guy in a wetsuit with his surfboard surfing. I mean, living in northern Wisconsin is hard, but when you have that, you'll pay the price a million times over to live on the shores of that lake.
You write about you're a very active family, you and your husband, your kids. You write about paddle boarding and kayaking. And do they surf?
No. I'm a little bit of a nervous Nelly. I'm not a very good swimmer, ironically. The kids always make fun of me because I always wear a life jacket. I'm a horrible swimmer, but they do everything.
Let's talk about some more recipes. There's a couple that I want. I've gone through the whole book, and I can't wait to try some of these things. The corn and smoked trout chowder.
So good. I know, because when I was coming up with that recipe, my husband Ted was like, I don't know about smoked trout and chowder. But people put bacon in.
You can put bacon in clam chowder all the time.
I know, and you can sub in smoked fish, especially smoked trout, because trout has that firmer texture.
Yeah.
Than you would find in a whitefish or even a salmon. Smoked salmon sometimes can be a little bit more moist.
And smoked trout is something that you can easily find in places like Cornucopia and a lot of the communities with their own small-scale fish processing facilities.
That's what's cool about Bayfield. I believe that we are one of the last working harbors on that part of the lake. There's some boats that come in and out of Port Wing and perhaps Herbster, but it's pretty unique to still have an active fishery.
So how do you make the corn chowder with smoked trout in it?
So the funny thing is, and it's weird, I was doing a book signing somewhere not near Bayfield, and a woman came up to me. Oh, no, I was down on La Crosse, I think. No. Yeah, La Crosse. And she came up and she's like, I'm so glad you put Corn Man Corn in there, because there's this guy named Baronet Bob who comes up every – we literally it's on Facebook when he shows up. And
he's got a truck with a pile of sweet corn in the back.
Totally. And he's the nicest guy. And we all – when Corn Man Bob comes up, there will be – he parks in a parking lot near a Jiffy Lube, and – the people, you'll drive by and there's a line snaking through, 20, 30 people will be waiting to get Corn Man Corn. And so I kind of wait till Corn Man shows up.
To get your corn for the chowder.
Because it really is so much better. I'm not joking.
Where do you get the trout from?
From Bodine's in Bayfield. Or there's another good Everett's from Port Wing. Makes some really fantastic smoked fish as well. So I'm lucky. I live where that's made. I think that down here in a city, I might imagine there's smoked fish at the grocery stores.
All right. Well, give us a recipe. Well,
chowder's pretty – I mean, that's what I love about soups and stews. They're pretty easy. You start out – well, I'm also a big fan of butter. I suppose you could use olive oil if you wanted to be virtuous. But I think if you're eating a chowder, just go all out. So just saute butter and onions and butter. And then I do a trick with the corn chowder that – you could do if you wanted to. If you wanted to save time, you could skip it. But I steep the corn cobs in milk in a saucepan because I love the taste of that sweet corn, that kind of earthy. And so the milk then takes on a little bit of that corn taste.
I've never heard of that before. You actually put the corn cob.
Yep.
And you boil the corn cob or steep it.
Yeah,
with the milk.
With the milk. To add that extra layer of corn. I mean, if you're not the biggest fan of corn, you probably wouldn't make this recipe anyways. But it does give that milk more of a corny taste, which sounds crazy. But it's little things like that that I think – what I think is – I like to say that recipes are just another way of telling a story. And so this is my part of the story. I really like corn. So, of course, I would come up with a recipe that tries to put as much corn as possible into that recipe. And someone that doesn't like corn as much, you can skip it. I mean – recipes for me have always just been a place to start and add your own spin, take stuff out, put stuff in. It's not – that's the point of cooking, is to have that storytelling through food.
You also use locally sourced goat cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the goat farm and your experience watching Birthing Day.
That was one of the – so Michael's a really good friend of mine. And just – I don't know, some like – Kila field party. I was like, I want to go figure out how to deliver baby goats. Michael's like, okay. And so I said in the book, he texted me, goats working on it, come now. And so I dropped everything and ran out to his farm, and I spent the day delivering goats, which took a little bit longer than I thought. And the kids, I was late to pick up the kids from school, and I was covered in like blood and hay and amniotic fluid. The kids got in the car. They rolled all the windows down, and they were like, what is that smell? And I was like, I'm delivering baby goats. It was so cool. Like, Michael had to put this rope. I was telling them, then they were just, the whole way home, they were just yelling, and the windows were down, and I was covered in goo. But I know, but how cool is that? I mean, you don't often get to be a goat midwife. So I got to do some midwifery. But I love Michael's goat cheese. His chef is not goaty. Sometimes some commercially prepared chef's a little too gamey, and his chef's really, really nice.
You've got a recipe for herbed goat cheese ravioli and also a sassy salmon en croûte, which I believe uses goat cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the salmon, since I'm on a fish riff now.
That came up because back in the day, I think one of the first New Year's, Christmas Eves we did with my family, my husband made salmon en croûte, which is just salmon you wrap in puff pastry. And I thought, I wonder what goat cheese would do with salmon. Sometimes you don't often serve cheese with fish, but Michael's chef is very, very mild. And so I thought, let's see what would happen. So I threw some sun-dried tomatoes in there, wrapped it up. Puff pastry is a really spectacularly wonderful thing, though. It's kind of like, there's a lot of butter in it, so it's kind of hard to go wrong with puff pastry. And just wrapped it up, and it's really, really good. Well, I mean, you should try it before you agree with me.
You've also write quite a bit about preserving the food that comes out of your garden. And you've got a recipe for preserved lemons, which is something I would never do. You can always buy lemons in a grocery store. But looking at that photo of yours with a jar of these beautiful,
I know, I'm out of
yellow
them now.
Lemons.
It's funny because I wanted to make this Moroccan cheese ball that's in the book, and I'm all out of preserved lemons because I use Meyer lemons, which Meyer lemons have a much thinner rind. Because the deal with preserved lemon is you're just preserving lemon and salt, so you can use the traditional lemons we find in the grocery store, but the rind's a little bit thicker, and they're like salty essence of lemon. I use them in everything, and I'm out of them. I think Meyer lemons, I should start seeing them at the store probably pretty soon here, and I'm just going to buy a case of them and make a bunch of preserved lemons.
I think we're going to take another break, and then we're going to come back on the other side and talk about more food and more about the culture of Lake Superior with Mary Doherty, the author of Life in a Northern Town, Cooking, Eating, and Other Adventures Along Lake Superior. I'm Glenn Moberg. Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, maybe you've got your own favorite holiday recipe, or you'd like to ask Mary a question about some of the food that she's prepared, give us a call, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742, or you can access our Route 51 webpage, wpr.org/Route 51. We are going to take a short break. Here's Graham Parker.
I'm born tired. The wood stove's last spark just expired. Dawn's about 1 hour away. And it's almost
Support for WPR comes from Hooper Corporation, supplying custom construction services, including electric power, mechanical, and green technology to commercial, industrial, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913. Support also comes from the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau, presenting the 2017 Birds in Art exhibition, with all new artwork by 114 artists through November 26th. LYWAM.org.
Sharp taking us into our next segment of Route 51 with Mary Doherty, author of Life in a Northern Town, Cooking, Eating, and Other Adventures Along Lake Superior. I'm Glenn Moberg. That phone number again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 webpage, wpr.org/Route 51. I'm old enough that I remember when this was actually on the radio.
I like it.
Yeah, Dee Dee Sharp, pre-Beatles. I think that was 1962 or 1963.
It's a little bit before my time, but not much.
So let's talk about Al Capone's roast. That's one of my favorite recipes that I happen upon in the book.
It's a good one. When my husband and I, he grew up in Cumberland, Wisconsin, which is kind of down. But we were, I don't know, in La Couderie, I think, where Al Capone was rumored to have hung out. So I knew that he had there's a Wisconsin hook with him. But I'd had a bunch of writers over for lunch one day, and I sat next to this woman named Renee, and we were talking about food, of course, because it's my, I'm interested in it. And she told me about this roast that I think they have at a store in Duluth called the Old World Meats, and it's called Al Capone's Roast. And you just take a flank steak and you butterfly it. So you take flanks about that big. Well, that's about the size of like a piece of a legal pad. And you cut it down the middle. And then you open it up like a book. And you put olives and sun-dried tomatoes and garlic and basil and cheese. And then you roll that bad boy up, take some string, and cook it or bake it off in the oven. And, wow, when you cut it, it's like just these little rolls of loveliness. Salty, briny, tomatoey, cheesy beef.
I'm going to try that one.
It's good. I mean, it's not.
And the picture looks great.
Yeah, when you're rolling it up, some of the stuff will kind of start to splooge out. Just stuff it back in there, and then roll it up tight, pretty tightly, And it, I like to, again, I like flavors, so I will saute it in a pan before I roast it off. If you don't, you don't have to do that, because that can cause some of the stuff to come out too. But I figure it's just dinner. Doesn't matter.
You take you took all the pictures, all the photos for the book. What's your approach to taking photos? Have you thought it through, or is it just something that comes to you intuitively?
Yeah, I don't do a whole lot of thinking things through, obviously. I bought a restaurant and I worked at Taco Bell, so go figure. But I don't know. I think that the world – what I love about photography is that it's a window into how someone sees the world. And so for me, I'm very interested in details and the nuance that often is missed when you're moving through. And so a lot of my photos are of they're close-ups. They're something that caught my eye. And I think one thing I tried to do in the book, relatively successful with, is that I wanted to put pictures of food before it was cooked, before it was on the plate. Because back to storytelling, you know, these apples are, you know, a picture of just three apples, that's chapter one. And that's always interesting for me to see where things start. And then how do we add our riff on it to make it part of our story? And I think that showing the food from as it was before we got involved is an important part.
And it takes a lot of apples to make apple cider.
Yes, I know. All this stuff. That's why it's expensive at the grocery store, because it's a lot of work. There's a lot of things that go into making apple cider.
And you mentioned that most of the orchards and most of the places that produce food are small family-run operations in the Bayfield area.
Yep. We don't have the sort of topography that lends itself well to large scale anything, to be honest with you. I mean, it's hills and there's a lake and the weather's somewhat inclement, you know, for a good part of the year. So it's people listening to, again, back to who are we, what do we value? And we value the lake. We value our clean water, our clean air, and our forest. And so our lives tend to be knit into that map of values.
Well, we haven't talked about dessert much. You've got a recipe for an apple strudel cheesecake.
And I made that for my son, Will, for his birthday. That's another really good one. It's just a cheesecake, basically, with, you know, caramelized or sautéed apples on top. And I was thinking today, we're on my way over here because I'm thinking about dinner, I'm thinking about making a pumpkin pie with a ginger snap crust. Doesn't that sound good?
It does.
I know. I mean, I know it's been done before. Maybe putting, like, some crystallized ginger in with the ginger snap crust, and then throwing the pumpkin pie. I mean, that's what I think is cool about cooking, like taking something that everyone does and then figuring out what's my spin, what can I do to make it my story.
Well, we're coming into winter, and winter is always a little bit brutal and very lovely also up north. Is the ferry still running to Madeline Island?
Yeah, actually, the ferry's run – I think the past two winters, we haven't had the cold. We had that big cold winter with the ice caves and everyone showed up and it was freezing and whatnot. But
if you have a cold winter and you get down to the last ferry trip to Madeline Island, that's kind of like a wake-up call for people who live on the island. They've got to get things done in a hurry.
It's just so cool. That's what I remember when I did that. There's an essay in here, The Last Ferry Ride, and it was, again, I think I get alerts on my phone from the ferry because my kids work on the island in the summer, so I just keep the alerts on. And I got an alert that said the last ferry to the island. And I told Ted, I was like, let's get on it and take pictures of – because for the island folks and also for us mainland folks, to have an ice road, which is what happens when the lake freezes, it allows access to a place that we don't have normally because of the ferry.
Have you ever driven the ice road to Madeline Island? I know you have because I read the story.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. You were driving on the ice road. This is when Lake Superior freezes up and you have to drive. It's like a couple of miles, isn't it, to get to Madeline Island from Bayfield?
Yep.
And you have to drive right over the ice on Lake Superior. It's marked with
Christmas trees.
Yeah. And you drove with the windows down and your seatbelt off. Why was that?
Well, like I said, I do. I mean, I'm a big believer in safety, and so my husband Ted's like, "Let's take the kids over to the island." I'm like, "No, we're all gonna die. This is not a good idea. We're gonna die. I can't be responsible for a carload full of dead children." And then, so I had all the kids take. It's so silly now because I would never do this, but I had the kids take their seatbelts off and roll the windows down, and it it's like anything. The first time you do something, it's a little bit freaky. And now we'll run over to the island in this winter when the ice rolls on just to grab lunch at the beach club, because it's, again, it's just knitting.
And that's in case you fall through the ice, you can get out of that car in a hurry.
But it's never going to happen. Like, it would never happen. That's the thing. You know, I was new to the area. I didn't know what was going on. But the cars don't just fall through the ice. By the time the ice road's up and running, it's safe. You can do it.
You write about your – how many dogs do you have?
I only have three right now.
You only have three. You write about the dogs quite a bit. And you've got a recipe for peanut butter – pumpkin peanut butter dog ice cream.
I know, because anyone that knows me, do you know there's a Cat Stevens song called "I Love My Dog"? My kids emailed it to me. He said, "This is your theme song," which is true because the dogs are special parts of our family. But we had a birthday party for my friend Amber's dog Hadley on the beach, and Amber, because you know if you're the mom of the birthday child, you have to supply the treats, and so we were talking. I'm like, "What? Let's make ice cream." And so we had a dog birthday party on the beach one day. And, yeah, they're spoiled.
What is the trick to making ice cream for a dog?
Well, there's not much of a trick. It's basically just – I mean, we're not making gelato here, right? We're just mixing some stuff in a bowl and you freeze it. That's what I love about dogs is they are the best people to cook for because they are always thankful.
One of the comfort foods that I will occasionally buy in the grocery store are like chicken pot pies.
And
they've got to be much better if you make them yourself. You've got a recipe for beefy pies with Stilton and Stout.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what goes into that.
I was just looking at that when I was coming over, you know, looking through the recipes. That's just basically, again, like I'm like a three trick pony. I'm good with soup, stew, and things with cheese. So it's basically just another – it's kind of like a riff on stew. It's not so saucy as a stew. And then you put it in little individual oven-safe pans, and you just put puff pastry on top. And it's good.
Do you cook a lot with venison?
I
do.
When I have a chance. My husband doesn't hunt any longer. So we'll get – people will give us venison. That venison –
A venison
back in, I don't even know how to say it.
I don't either. I was going to ask you how to say it. You don't know how to. It's Bachofe. Is that Bischoff?
Bischoff, yeah. Bischoff? It's an Austrian German. A friend of mine had given me a bunch of venison, and I wanted to do something different with it. And so it's basically just a layered. You take a big cast iron pot or some, you know, oven proof again. And you just layer in venison and potatoes and some bacon. You top it off with bacon and throw it in the oven, and it's easy and good. The thing that I've made with it that's really, really good is on page 119, the braised cabbage with quince, apples, and cranberries. I think I'm going to make that to go along with Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's really, really good, and it has a little bit of a you need something –
It's red cabbage, mm-hmm. right? And then it's like the old German recipe where you cook the red cabbage.
Exactly.
But it looks like you don't cook it as much as the Germans.
No, I don't like to cook the heck out of stuff. I like it to have a little bit. I mean, you can if you like that. But it has a nice certain of acidity because of the apple cider vinegar that cuts would do a good job with turkey, I think.
I just checked the time, and we're completely out of it.
Nice.
Mary, thank you so much for being with us.
Wonderful.
We could have kept talking here for another couple of hours, but I enjoyed the time that
we spent
together.
This was fun.
And I really appreciate you driving down here so we could do this in person.
I'm happy to.
Thank you, Mary Doherty.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
We want to thank today's guest, author Mary Doherty, whose new book is titled Life in a Northern Town, Cooking, Eating, and Other Adventures Along Lake Superior. The book is published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and you can find out more about it at wisconsinhistory.org. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Janice Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Bing Crosby, Randy Sabine, the Pointer Sisters, Weird Al Yankovic, Graham Parker, Dee Dee Sharp, and Arlo Guthrie. Henry. Next Thursday, Thanksgiving, Route 51 is taking the day off so we can broadcast a network special. We will be back on Thursday, November 30th, with a look at the opioid crisis in north central Wisconsin. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Thanks again for riding along with us. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago. It was on